What's up with the script?
Why don't you shoot it before you bitch about it?
The gun was so small it almost disappeared in his hand. Kellaway lifted it, looked down the sight, and saw a green dot floating across Barack Obama's forehead.
When did you start to go for James Bond shit like this?
Kellaway asked.
I've always dug the James Bond shit. Laser sights, incendiary bullets. I look forward to our smart gun future if the NRA ever lets us have it. I'd like a gun that knows my name and how I take my coffee. Who doesn't want that?
Me, Kellaway said and fired. He put one in Obama's left eye, one in his forehead, one in his throat, one in zombie Bin Laden's mouth, two in Dick Cheney's pacemaker.
Give me Bruce Willis over Roger Moore any day. I don't want a gun with a laser beam and a British accent. I want a gun that speaks American, and it looks like it was built to make holes in school buses.
Why would you need to shoot through a school bus?
If you knew what my neighbor's kids were like, you'd understand.
He traded the gun for a glass of scotch, had a swallow. It tasted sweetly of vanilla and went down like kerosene. Ignited the lining of his throat. Made him feel like an explosive just waiting for someone to pull the pin.
Mary is in a mood. Mary is always in a mood, Jim said.
He waved at the haze in the air, blinking reddened eyes and coughing weakly. Kellaway wondered if it was just the smoke or if he was carrying a cold.
She was gone. Late Saturday night, and my piss bag got too full. Popped a tube and soaked my pants.
Kellaway didn't have any sympathy for that.
You can't change your own piss bag? I forgot to check it. Mary does that for me. But she was off getting shit-faced at TGI Fridays with the girlfriends. They like to go out on the weekend and talk trash about their men. I assume Mary has more trash to talk than most. Her friends can say they don't get laid enough, but none of their men need a hydraulic device to get a 30-second stiffy.
He reloaded methodically.
I'm sitting there in urine. She gets back and starts in on me about money, about how her credit card bounced, like I haven't already been pissed on enough. Yeah, she was saying inside she wants you to sell some of your guns. Like I could get anything for them? Everyone is selling guns online. They're cheaper than the steel they're made of. You got anything you want to dump? I mean, the kind of thing you can own without shame as an American. Not one of these guns where you feel like you got to shoot it with one pinky sticking out like it's a teacup and you're sitting down to scones with the queen.
Jim lifted his mug of scotch, held it under his lips without drinking.
You want to feel like a gunslinger? I've got a .44 super mag that'll make holes the size of a cabbage in the unlucky target of your choice. Maybe something a little smaller.
Jim drank deeply, swallowed, coughed a rough barking cough into his fist.
I got a few things. We could talk, I guess. It would get Mary off my back. You wanted to take one of the older guns for a few bucks.
Kellaway said,
Jim, I can't pass a background check. I've got that injunction hanging over me. That bitch lawyer of hers destroyed me in court.
Hey, you didn't tell me and I didn't ask. I don't got to do a background check. I'm not a gun dealer. I won't get in trouble. You might, but I won't.
Jim touched the joystick on the right armrest of his wheelchair. The chair spun halfway around with a whine of servo motors. Then he stopped and angled a dark, almost belligerent look up into Kellaway's face.
I sell you a gun, though. You gotta swear one thing.
Yeah. What's that? You ever decide to go on a killing spree?
Jim Hurst said.
Promise you'll start with me.
July 6, 2013. 9:38 a.m. Raj texted her to see if she could pop into work a half hour before opening. Becky texted him back.
I need it too. So bad.
but he didn't reply. In the car, she put on a pale lipstick that gave her mouth the appearance of being lightly frosted in jizz. She adjusted her cardigan so the upper lacy bits of her black and emerald bra were showing. And after consideration, she reached under her skirt and wiggled out of her panties. She poked them into the glove compartment, next to the present that had been there ever since Christmas. The Miracle Falls Mall was cool and quiet at that hour. Hardly anyone there, most of the stores still closed, steel grates pulled down across their wide entrances. The gate was pulled up at Boost Your Game, but the two dudes who had the morning shift were just horsing around, taking 3-point shots on the basket located in the center of the store. Their happy shouts and the squeak of their sneakers echoed all the way down the corridor to the central atrium. Becky didn't see anyone else the whole walk to Devotion Diamonds, except for Kellaway, the top cop in the mall, although, of course, he wasn't really a cop at all. Raj said the real cops didn't want him, that he'd done some skeevy Abu Ghraib shit in Iraq and had been discharged in disgrace. Raj said Kellaway would follow black kids around in the mall, fondling his footlong flashlight, like he was just looking for a reason to crack some skulls. Becky and Kellaway were both heading in the same direction, but she fell back a few paces, let him march away from her up the central staircase. He had oddly colorless eyes that gave an unsettling impression of blindness. He had eyes the hue of very cold water over very pale stone. Devotion Diamonds was at the top of the stairs, the plexiglass doors halfway opened. She turned sideways and slipped between them. The display area always smelled like money to her, like the inside of a new car. The gems weren't out yet, but still locked away in their drawers. When it was closed, the door to the office blended in with the fake cherry paneling in the back of the shop, but at the moment it was partly ajar, looking into a cube of fluorescent light. She pushed it the rest of the way in. Raj was behind the desk, wearing a yellow shirt and a wide brown knit tie. He was smoking, which surprised her. She had never seen him smoke in the morning. The big window at the back of the room was cranked open, probably to air out the smell of the cigarette, which was funny, actually. He was letting more smoke in than he was venting, the haze from the Ocala fire giving the air a filmy texture. He typed something on his big silver iMac, clicked a key, and pivoted in his leather chair to look at her. He flicked his cigarette out the open window without looking to see where it went. His gestures were jerky and abrupt, and unlike him, and it made her nervous. "Hey, Bean," he said. "What's up?" she asked. The thing about calling her Bean unsettled her even more. That was what he called her right up until they started fucking. He called some of the other girls who worked for him Bean, too, a term of fatherly endearment. He squeezed the bridge of his nose between his fingers. "So, one of my wife's friends told her to look at your Instagram feed." Her stomach cinched tight, but she kept her face expressionless. "Yeah? Who cares? There aren't any photos of us together." "There's a photo of you on my boat." "How would anyone know it's your boat?" She narrowed her eyes, trying to visualize what had been in that picture, a selfie. Her grinning up into her phone, holding a green appletini in one hand, a drink that matched her lime green bikini top. The caption read something like, "Until we go to the south of France, the only place to sunbathe naked is on Bay's yacht, LOL. It could be anyone's boat." "You think my wife doesn't know my boat when she sees it? So tell her I asked if I could use it. Tell her I was out with my boyfriend." She put her hands on the edge of the desk, using her arms to squeeze her breasts together, and leaned in to kiss him. "You won't even be lying," she breathed. He wheeled back from her in his chair, putting himself out of reach. "I already told her a different story." She straightened up and hugged herself. "What did you tell her?" "That you took the keys out of my desk without asking me. That you must have gone for a joyride. She asked if I was going to fire you. I said you'd be gone by the time we opened. He pushed a small cardboard box across the desk. Until he touched it, she hadn't noticed it there. I had some of your stuff in my car, and you had a few personal items in your cubby. I think I got all of it. Well, shit. I guess we have to start being more careful. Sucks you have to fire me, though. I made plans around my next few checks. It also sucks that your first instinct was to lie to your wife in a way that made me sound like a skeeve. Bean, he said, I don't regret 1 minute of it, not one. But I will if there's 1 minute more. So, there it was. He gave the box another slight nudge. There's something else in there for you. Token of my feelings. She folded back a flap and picked out a small black velvet box on the top of the mess. It contained a silver bracelet crafted to look like a stave on a piece of sheet music, with a fake diamond G-clef set on it. Cheap junk they couldn't give away. You were music in my days, kiddo. That sounded cheap, too. It would have been corny and a sympathy card. She dropped the black velvet box on the desk. I don't want that shit. What do you think you're doing?
You know what I'm doing. Don't make it any harder. It's hard enough already.
How can you pick her over me? Becky found it hard to breathe. The room had a bitter blue campfire smell, the stink of the Ocala blaze, and it was impossible to get enough air.
You hate her. You told me you can't stand hearing her voice. You spend all day trying to figure out how to avoid spending time with her. Besides, what do you have to lose? You told me you had a prenup.
Thinking that sounded very adult, calling it a prenup. I do have a prenuptial agreement. Her prenuptial agreement. Becky, these stores are all hers. I don't keep the shirt on my back if she walks. I thought you understood that. He looked at his watch. She's going to call in 10 minutes to see how it went. Plus, I have to open. We better go over the ground rules. Don't try to meet up with me. Don't come back to the store. I'll send you your last check. Don't text. Her throat tightened some more. It was the blunt, almost impersonal efficiency in his voice. He might have been discussing store policy with a new employee.
This is bullshit, she said. You think this is how you get to end things? You're out of your fucking mind if you think you can just throw me out like a used rubber.
Hey, now.
Something you blew a load in and don't want to look at anymore?
Don't, Bean.
Stop calling me that.
Becky. He laced his fingers together and looked tiredly down into the bowl of his palms. Things end. Cherish the good times.
And get the fuck out with my shitty half-price bracelet.
Keep your voice down, he barked. Who knows who's walking around? Ann Malibu and Bath and Body Works is friends with my wife personally. I think Ann is the one who told her to look at your Instagram feed. She must have seen us together making out in the Lamborghini or something. Who knows what Ann has said to my wife?
Who knows what I might say to her?
What's that mean?
It would teach you something, wouldn't it?
What she wanted to say was, if his wife knew about them, then there wouldn't be any reason to break up anymore. If it was a choice between his wife's 48-year-old pussy and hers, she had a pretty good idea which one Raj would pick. Don't go there.
Why?
Because. I want this to be nice. I'm trying to end it nice. I'm trying to protect us both. You go to her with a story about us sleeping together. She'll think you're just a disgruntled clerk who got busted.
I didn't steal your boat, douchebag.
You think she'd believe that shit if she talked to me? I think she'd believe you walked out of here with a pair of $800 diamond earrings, since you used your pass card to log them out of the store in December, and they never came back.
The fuck are you talking about? I never stole any $800 earrings.
Christmas, he said. The hotel.
The hotel? She asked.
She didn't get it. And then she did. Remembered the night he gave her the ivory-handled pistol. The night she draped herself in almost $500,000 of gems for him. When I took out all that jewelry for us to play with, I used your security card, not mine. I guess we missed the earrings when we cleaned up the room. Honest accident. We were both pretty trashed. The point is, they went missing after you checked them out. That thought, and everything that came with it, took a moment to settle upon her.
You knew you were going to break up with me all the way back in December,
she said in a soft, disbelieving voice, speaking to herself more than to him.
Half a year ago, you already knew you were going to blow me off. So you planned some bullshit to make me look like a thief. You were plotting this blackmail shit half a year ago.
She didn't believe for one second those earrings had been carelessly left behind at the hotel. They weren't an accident. They were insurance. He shook his head.
No, Bean. It's terrible you'd even think that.
What did you do with them? The earrings?
I don't know what happened to them. I honestly don't. All I know is they never came back. Come on. I hate that I even have to say any of this. My marriage is older than you are, and I'm not going to let some hysterical, vindictive kid tear up my life just because she wants something she can't have.
She felt cold, shivery, so cold she almost expected to see her own breath.
You can't do this to someone. It isn't right.
He cocked himself back in his chair, turning slightly, sticking out his legs and crossing his ankles. For the first time, she noticed he had a little beer belly, a soft roll of fat hanging over his belt.
I want you to go home, kid. You're upset. You need some time to be alone. Feel what you got to feel. Believe it or not, I'm in mourning, too. You're not the only one who lost out here.
What did you lose out on? You haven't lost out. You have everything you ever had.
I don't have you. I'm mourning that.
He looked at her through lowered eyelashes.
Go on. Be good. Don't try to contact me, and for God's sake, don't try to contact my wife. Let's not be stupid. I just want what's best for both of us.
You're in mourning?
You're in fucking mourning?
Believe it or not, I am. It makes me sick we can't end things on a more positive note.
She quivered. She felt fevered one moment and frozen the next. She really thought she was going to be sick.
I'm not mourning you, she said, and no one else is going to either.
He looked a question at her, furrowing his brow, but she didn't say any more. She didn't know she was backing up until her hip struck the edge of the open door. The impact turned her partly away from him, and she let it, swung around, and went out into the shop. She did not run. She walked very stiffly, without bending her legs. In no hurry. She was gone for only about 30 minutes. 10:03 a.m. Becky didn't cry. For a long time she sat clutching the steering wheel, holding it so tightly her knuckles were white, even though she wasn't going anywhere. She was just sitting there in the parking lot, looking at a bank of black plexiglass doors leading into the mall. There were moments when rage seemed to push down on her whole body, as if she were an astronaut experiencing the gravity of some larger, denser, more terrible world. She was squeezed, felt the air being crushed out of her. When he left work, Rod usually came out on this side of the mall. If she saw him now, if he stepped through those shiny black doors squinting into the morning sunlight, She'd start the car and stamp on the gas and launch her little VW right into him. The thought of hitting him with the car, the thud, the yelp, the crunch of the tires going over him, thrilled her and made it easier to stand up against that cruel alien gravity. He had fucked her for months while he was figuring out how to get rid of her. He came in her face, in her hair, and she acted like she enjoyed it, batting her eyelashes at him and purring. And it struck her now that he thought she was pathetic and childish. And he was right. It made her want to scream until her throat hurt. Gravity doubled, tripled. She could feel it squashing her organs. It maddened her how easy it had been for him to stomp on her, to squash her under his heel. He had boxed her in with such tidy efficiency. He was probably on the phone with the wife now, telling her some story about how he'd confronted her, how hard it had been to fire her while she begged and wept and made excuses. The wife was probably comforting him, as if he were the one who'd been through something awful this morning. It wasn't right. "It isn't right," she said through her teeth, unconsciously pumping her foot on the gas pedal to punctuate each word. The car wasn't running, but she mashed the pedal anyway. "It isn't right." She needed something to steady her, and yanked open the glove compartment, fumbled around, and found a bottle of Rogers Putumayo cocaine, razor blade sharp stuff he'd picked up himself on an emerald buying trip to Colombia. The coke went off like a bullet in the brain. Becky spotted a black lace panties crumpled in the open glove compartment. The sight of them was vaguely humiliating, and she grabbed for them to put them back on. They'd gotten tangled around the butt of her Christmas gun, and it came tumbling out with them. The .357 was shoved into the thigh holster with the straps and buckles, which was the way she kept it, although she'd never worn it anywhere. The sight of it was like drawing a deep breath. She took it in her hands and held it, and was very still. As a child, in the days before Christmas, Becky would sometimes pick up a favorite snow globe, showing a little pond and people in 19th-century dress, skating amid the glitter, and she would crank the key in the bass and listen to the music. Noel, Noel, and tell herself stories about the people under the glass. She found herself doing the same thing now, only with the gun instead of a snow globe. She stared down at its etched silver barrel and pictured herself walking into Devotion Diamonds with it. In her imagination, Raj was still in the office, on the phone with his wife, wasn't aware of her entering the store. She floated to the extension of the customer fulfillment nook and picked up the line.
"Mrs. Lewis?"
she said in a pleasantly social voice.
"Hi. It's Becky. I just wanted you to know that whatever Roger told you about me isn't true. He just doesn't want you to know he was fucking me. He said if I ever tried to tell you the truth about us, he'd make it look like I stole things from the store and have me arrested. But I know I couldn't survive even one day in jail, not even overnight, and I feel sick to have committed the sin of adultery with him. I can't ever make it up to you, but I can apologize. And I am so sorry, Mrs. Lewis. You will never understand how much."
And then she'd shoot herself, right in his store, right by the phone. That would stick it to him, leave him with a corpse and blood all over the white shag carpet. Or maybe she'd march into his office and jam the gun into her temple and pull the trigger in front of him. She wanted to hear him scream before she did it. She'd been in the car screaming the word "no" over and over again in her head for almost half an hour. Now it was his turn. She felt if she could hear him scream it just once, "no," it would almost be worth it to blow her brains out. She needed to see some horror on his face, needed him to know he didn't have control of everything. But then, if she wanted to see some horror in his face, it might be better to point the gun at him, point it at his cock, see if he'd plead like she had pleaded, or make him text the truth to his wife.
Make him eat $10,000 of diamonds. Make him write an email to everyone at Devotion Diamonds and apologize to them personally for fucking a 20-year-old employee, disgracing himself in the eyes of his wife and the Lord. The possibilities swirled like bright flecks of snow in a snow globe, like bright flecks of diamond bright Putumayo cocaine. At some point she wriggled back into her underwear. She felt a little less dirty then. The sun was well up over the trees and it was getting stuffy in the car, and suddenly she needed to get out into cooler air. She brought the gun with her. The hazy bright of late morning made her head ache. She reached back into the car for her cheap pink sunglasses. Better. It would hide her bloodshot eyes, too. She wasn't sure what she was going to do, but she knew she wanted to look good doing it. She leaned back into the car, collected the flower print do-rag she wore to the gun range, and wrapped her hair to keep it out of her face. Last, she rucked up her skirt and buckled the holster onto her thigh. It was still early, and it wasn't busy inside the mall. A scattering of people strolled among the shops. Her heels cracked on the marble like gunshots. With each step she felt she was leaving all thought behind, all anxiety. Becky climbed the stairs in the atrium for the second time that morning. She was halfway up when the holster began to slip down her thigh. She was hardly aware of it happening until it abruptly dropped to her knee. She tugged it awkwardly back up without slowing. She wasn't looking where she was going, and her shoulder thudded into a guy going down the stairs past her. It was the tall, skinny black kid who worked in Booster Game, carrying a pair of frosty coffee drinks. She didn't make eye contact with him, and didn't look back as she wrestled the holster into place. She had a sense he'd stopped walking and was staring at her. She didn't feel emotional at all. She felt as glassy and inanimate as one of the skaters in her old snow globe. So it surprised her when, at the very top of the stairs, she turned her ankle and stumbled. She hadn't known that her legs were trembling. A fat dude with curly hair came out of nowhere to grab her elbow and steady her. He had a breakfast crunch wrap in his free hand. Scrambled eggs fell out of it and spattered across the floor. "You okay?" he asked her. He was a pimply, moon-faced boy in a too-tight striped polo that clung to his man boobs. He smelled of hot salsa and virginity. "Fuck off me," she said and jerked her arm out of his soft hand. It was horrible to be touched. He lurched aside and she clacked unsteadily along, but the holster had slipped down to her knee again, the fucking thing. She hadn't cinched the straps tight enough. Becky cursed, pulled at the buckles, tore the holster off, and clutched the whole mess to her stomach. Anyone who looked might think it was a purse. Devotion Diamonds was a labyrinth of glass display cases, bulletproof coffins for artfully arranged bracelets and earrings and crosses and medallions. Raj was at the fulfillment center in a back corner. He was completing a transaction with a pretty dark-skinned lady in a dove-colored cloak or dress, and one of those headscarves the Arabs wore. A hijab, that was the word. Becky was obscurely proud of herself for knowing it. She wasn't as ignorant as Raj thought. Raj took the Muslim woman's order with an air of hushed calm, speaking in the fond, approving tone he always used when someone was about to give him money. He had left the panel into the back office open, and Becky aimed herself at it, keeping her hands low, the gun beneath the level of the display cases where he couldn't see it. She caught his eye on the way past, nodded for him to follow. His jaw tightened. The Muslim saw his change of expression and glanced around. Becky took in that the Muslim lady had an infant in a baby Bjorn worn against her chest. The baby was facing inward, asleep beneath a striped blue cap. The mom had enormous eyelashes above her dark eyes and was really very pretty. Becky wondered if she had tried something on, and Raj had told her she was unblemished. She swept by them both and into the office, pushing the panel partway shut behind her. She shook with adrenaline. She hadn't thought about other people being around.
The window overlooking the rear lot was still wide open, and Becky went behind the desk, thinking that another deep breath of the outside air might calm her. Then Becky was in a position to see what was on the screen of Raj's iMac, and she went very still. She took off her sunglasses, put them down, blinked at the screen. "One moment, ma'am," Raj was saying in his smooth, hushed voice, but Becky knew him well enough to recognize the barely suppressed urgency just beneath the surface. "I'll be right back."
"Is everything all right?"
"Yes, perfect, perfect. One more moment and we'll get you rung out. Thanks. Thanks so much." Becky heard him murmuring away, but it hardly registered. It was only background noise, like the whoosh of the air conditioning vents. A messaging program was open on the big iMac. Raj had been trading texts with someone named Bo. The most recent was a picture of Becky on her knees in slick silver panties, mouth open, hair blown across her face, leaning forward for some cock. Beneath that was Raj's most recent text. "At least I'll always have this to remember her by. Plus, she loved it up the ass. I didn't even have to ask. Second date." And Bo's reply, "Shit, dude, I hate you. How come good things never happen to me?" Raj slipped into the office, saw her staring at the computer, and deflated. "Okay," he said. "I admit, that was inconsiderate. I shouldn't have shared that photo with anyone. I was depressed and trying to cheer myself up by being callous and nasty. So shoot me for having feelings." Becky barked with laughter. 10:37 a.m. When he heard the first shot, Kellaway slopped his coffee. He didn't react to the second shot at all, just stood midway down the food court, head cocked, listening. Independence Day was barely over, and the thought was in his mind that it might be kids fucking off with some firecrackers. He'd managed to scald the shit out of his hand, but he made no move, letting the sounds sink in. When the gun went off a third time, he threw his cup at the wastebasket. He missed. The paper cup hit the side of the can and erupted, but he wasn't around to see coffee going everywhere. By then he was running in a crouch toward the sound of pistol fire. He ran past Spencer Gifts and Sunglass Hut and Lids, saw women and their kids crouched behind pillars and displays, and felt his heartbeat thudding in his eardrums. Everyone knew the drill, had seen it all on TV. Get down, be ready to run if the shooter comes in sight. Kellaway's walkie-talkie awoke in a blast of noise, frightened voices, and feedback. "What is that, guys? Guys? Guys! Anyone know? Oh, fuck. Shots fired. That shot's fired, holy fuck. I'm in Sears. Should we lock it down? Can someone tell me if we're in a lockdown situation, or am I sending people to the exits, or..." "Mr. Kellaway? Mr. Kellaway, it's Ed Dowling. What's your 20? Repeat, what's your..." Kellaway turned his walkie-talkie off. A fat 20-something, a kid who kind of looked like that actor Jonah Hill, was sprawled face down on the glossy stone floor, just outside Devotion Diamonds. He heard Kellaway coming, looked back, and began waving one hand in a gesture that seemed to mean, "Get down, get down." He had a wrapped sandwich or burrito in the other hand. Kellaway dropped to one knee, thinking it had to be an armed robbery. He imagined men in balaclavas using sledgehammers to smash the display cases, grabbing jewels by the fistful. His right hand went to the heavy iron on his left ankle. Fat kid gasped for breath, was having trouble getting words out. He flailed one hand toward Devotion Diamonds.
"Tell me what you know," Kellaway whispered. "Who's in there?"
The fat kid said, "Muslim, female shooter, and the owner. He's dead, I think." Kellaway's own breath whistled thin and fast. A fucking Al-Qaeda thing, then. He had thought he'd left the black veils and the suicide bombers in Iraq, but here they were. He jerked up his pant leg and unsnapped the Ruger Federal that Jim Hurst let him have for $120. He tugged its lovely weight out of the ankle holster. Kellaway scuttled to a mirrored column at the entrance to the shop, pressed himself against it so hard his breath clouded the glass. He darted a look around the corner. Display cases divided the floor into zigzagging corridors. The paneled door into the private office at the rear was open. A black-tinted globe on the ceiling hid the camera that monitored the store floor. That wasn't one of the mall's cameras, which watched only common areas. That would be Devotion Diamond's private security. Kellaway couldn't see anyone in the store, not another soul. He moved, dropped to his hands and knees, and crawled into the shop. The air smelled of gun smoke. Kellaway heard a rustle of movement to his right, in the corner, near the fulfillment nook. He didn't have a good angle on it, not where he was. He made it to the end of one Z-shaped display counter. The open office door was just a yard away. This was the moment, maybe the last moment. He closed his eyes. He thought of his son, thought of George, saw him clearly, squeezing a stuffed penguin to his chest and holding it up for Daddy to kiss. He opened his eyes and came uncoiled, threw himself against the wall just to one side of the office door. He lifted the gun and swiveled to cover the fulfillment nook. The woman rose at the same time, a small, almost elfin Muslim in the hijab and gown, bomb vest strapped to her chest, bulging with explosives, and a silver trigger in one hand. He put a bullet through her center mass. The moment he did it, he realized he had shot right through the packed explosive, too. He waited for the spark and the flash, waited to be carried away in a clap of light. But it didn't go off. She fell. The bullet had punched right through her and into the mirror behind her, the glass splintering in a red spider web. Something clattered in the office to his left. He saw movement at the edge of his vision, glanced, saw another woman. She wore a hijab, too. This one a pretty flowered gauzy cloth. She clutched a silver pistol with a lot of fancy filigree on it. The shooter was white, but that didn't surprise him. They were pretty good at turning white girls into soldiers for Allah online. There was a corpse on the floor between them at their feet, Roger Lewis, the guy who owned the place. He was on his stomach, the back of his shirt soaked with blood. It looked like he had collapsed onto his desk. Maybe grabbed at his big iMac to stay on his feet, and then slid off and rolled onto his face. He had almost pulled the computer off the desk with him. The big silver monitor was precariously balanced on a back corner, looked like it might crash at any moment. The convert was so close he could have reached out to grab her. Some of her blonde hair had come loose from the wrap over her head. A long golden strand was stuck to one damp, flushed cheek. She gaped at him, then looked into the next room, but from here she couldn't see the body in the fulfillment nook. "Your partner is gone," he said. "Put it down."
"You shouldn't have done that," she told him, perfectly calm.
Her gun went off with a crack and a pop and a flash of light. He fired back instinctively and flung most of her right lung up onto the desk. His scalp tingled. The barrel of her .357 was still pointing at the floor. If he was shot, he couldn't feel it, not yet. She stared at him with bewildered, stunned eyes. When she tried to speak, she gurgled blood. Her right hand began to drift up with her weapon. He caught it and twisted it out of her grip. And that was when he saw that the iMac had tilted off the desk and hit the floor. He played the crack and pop and flash of light back in his head, then pushed the notion aside before it could even fully form. No. He had heard a shot. He was sure it had been a shot, and not the sound of a falling computer. He even had a half-memory of the slug passing by so closely it had seemed to twitch the fabric of his shirt. The convert sagged. He almost stepped in to catch her, but at the last moment he deflected her with his left arm to keep her from tumbling into him. She wasn't a person anymore. She was just evidence. She flopped across Roger Lewis and was still. His ears rang strangely. The world expanded and brightened around him, and for a moment he had the ridiculous idea that he was close to fainting. The air was blue from gunfire. He stepped out of the office, backing away from the pile of dead. Kellaway saw the other radical on her back staring at the ceiling, still clutching the trigger for the explosives. He took a step nearer to kick her hand free from the button. He wondered what kind of explosive she had packed into the vest, which looked a bit like a converted baby Bjorn. He saw a pair of small, dusky fists clutching the front of her gown, but the image didn't make sense to him, not at first. He looked at the trigger in her right hand, and saw a silver letter opener with an opal in the handle instead of a black button. He frowned. He glanced at the bomb vest again. The cap covering the infant's head had come loose. He could see an inch of scalp, lightly dusted in tan fuzz.
"Holy shit, dude," came a voice from his right.
He looked and saw the fat kid who resembled Jonah Hill. He had walked right up to stand behind Kellaway, had wandered in, still clutching his breakfast burrito. He looked at the bodies heaped in the office, then at the dead woman and her dead baby.
"What'd you shoot her for?"
the fat kid asked.
"She was just hiding, man."
"I asked you who was in the store. You said Muslim female shooter."
"No, I didn't," the fat kid said. "You asked who was in here. I said a Muslim female shooter and the owner." "Holy shit. I thought you'd go in and save her, not blow her the fuck away like a fucking madman."
"I didn't blow her away,"
Kellaway said in a dull, leaden voice.
"A crazy bitch in the office killed this one. Understand? It wasn't me, it was her. Tell me you understand."
The fat kid laughed a little wildly. He didn't understand. He didn't get it at all. He waved a hand at the mirrored wall where the bullet had struck after passing through the Arab and her baby. A silvery pink web of shatter lines that spread across the glass marked the point of impact.
"Dude, I saw you shoot her. I saw you. Plus they're gonna pick the bullet out of the wall. Forensics."
He shook his head.
"You were out of your fucking mind. I thought you were going to stop a rampage, not go on one yourself. You killed more people than she did. Christ, I'm just glad you didn't shoot me."
"Huh," Kellaway said.
"What?"
"Now that you mention it,"
Kellaway told him, and raised the shooter's fancy filigreed gun. 10:59 a.m. Harbaugh was first up the stairwell, lumbering to the top in 60 pounds of black Teflon armor. Halfway up, he stepped on something fleshy and heard a cry. A skinny black kid was stretched out flat on the stairs, and Harbaugh had mashed his hand with one boot heel. Harbaugh kept going, didn't apologize. When you were in the middle of a mass shooting, manners were the first thing out the window. At the top of the steps, he put his back against a round plaster pillar and snuck a look along the second floor gallery. It was fucking apocalyptic. 2 acres of polished marble floor, brightly lit, and only a few people scattered around, all of them hiding behind potted plants or spread prostrate on the floor. Like that movie about the Walking Dead taking over the mall. Matchbox 20 played on the sound system. Harbaugh made his move, sprinting across the corridor. 2 other guys on the team right behind him, Slaughter and Velasquez. He was on his sights the whole way. The guys called it Xbox time, hunt and shoot. He hit the wall to one side of the store entrance and dipped his helmeted head around the corner into the shop. After his very first glance, though, he lowered his weapon a few inches. A single security guard stood in one corner facing a shattered mirror. The guy was tranced out, in a daze, poking one finger at a bullet hole in the center of the glass. He wasn't carrying, but there were a pair of pistols resting on one of the display cases beside him.
"Hey," Harbaugh said in a soft voice.
"Police." The guy seemed to rouse himself, shook his head, stepped away from the smashed mirror.
"You can stand down. It's all done,"
the security guard told him. The mall cop was in his 40s, sculpted, big arms, big muscly neck, hair in a marine crew. How many down?
Harbaugh asked.
Shooter is in the office, on top of one of the victims,
the mall cop said.
They're both dead. I got three more in here. One's a baby.
He didn't choke on that last word, but he did need to clear his throat before saying it. Harbaugh's insides went sick and loose at that. Harbaugh had a 9-month-old himself and didn't want to see an infant with its skull smashed open like a pink egg. He padded into the store all the same, boots almost silent on the thick carpet. A fat kid, maybe 20, had been thrown across one of the display cases, a bullet hole almost perfectly between his eyes. His mouth was open as if to object. Harbaugh glimpsed a dead girl in a do-rag sprawled over a white male in the office.
Are you hurt? Harbaugh asked.
Mall cop shook his head.
No, just I might have to sit down.
Sir, you should exit the premises. My colleagues will walk you out.
I want a moment here with the woman. I want to sit with her for a bit to say I'm sorry.
The mall cop was looking at his feet. Harbaugh glanced past his ankles and saw a woman in a pigeon-gray robe, eyes open and staring blankly at the drop ceiling. The baby was tucked into an infant carrier, perfectly still, face down against his mother's breast. The mall cop put a hand on the display counter and gently lowered himself to the carpet and sat beside her. He took her hand, moved his fingers over her knuckles, lifted them to his mouth, and kissed them.
"This woman and her baby shouldn't be dead," the mall cop said. "I hesitated, and that crazy cunt in the office killed her. Killed her and the baby both. One shot. How am I going to live with that?"
"The only one to blame for what happened to them is the person who pulled the trigger," Harbaugh said. "You remember that."
The mall cop considered this and then nodded slowly, his colorless eyes vacant and far away.
"I'll try," he said.
11:11 a.m. The ESU officer named Harbaugh helped Kellaway stand up and kept an arm around him as they walked into the corridor. They left the guns and the dead behind. Harbaugh walked Kellaway to a stainless steel bench in the hall and eased him down onto it. A pair of EMTs wheeled a gurney past. Harbaugh told Kellaway to sit tight and stepped away. It was getting crowded in the hall. Uniformed police had turned up. Kellaway saw a gang of Indian kids, India Indians, not American Indians, standing 10 yards off, and two of them were filming everything with their cell phones. Someone yelled to push the onlookers back. A pair of cops stalked past carrying a sawhorse. Ed Dowling, with mall security, appeared at one side of the bench. He was a ridiculous stork of a man, with a prominent Adam's apple and an inability to make eye contact with anyone.
"You okay?"
Dowling asked, looking at his own feet.
"No,"
Kellaway said.
"You want water?"
Dowling said.
"I could get you some water.
I want to be alone for a minute."
"Oh, okay.
Yeah, I get that." He began to shuffle away, moving sideways like a man creeping along a high, narrow ledge.
"Wait, help me up, Edward. I think I'm going to be sick, and I don't want it all over YouTube."
Nodding toward the pack of 15-year-old Hindus, or whatever they were.
"Oh, yeah. Okay, Mr. Kellaway," Dowling said. "Let's go into Lids. They've got a can in the storage room out back."
He took Kellaway by the forearm and winched him to his feet. They crossed to Lids, next door to Devotion Diamonds, and made their way past racks of baseball caps. A dozen Kellaways walked with them, reflected in the mirrored walls. A big, tired-looking man with circles under his eyes and blood on the hip of his uniform. He wasn't sure how that had gotten there. Dowling used his key ring to open a mirrored panel that doubled as the door to storage. Just before they stepped through into the back, Kellaway heard someone shout. "Hey!" called a uniformed officer with a plump pink face. It amazed Kellaway that the force took such soft, out-of-shape suburban dad types and yet had turned him down. "Hey, wait! He needs to stay out here. He's a witness." "He's sick is what he is," said Dowling with a sharpness that took Kellaway by surprise. "He ain't gonna York up out there with a bunch of nimwits filming him. He just nearly got himself killed stopping a mass shooting. Now he ought to be allowed 30 seconds to compose himself. That's just being decent." He nudged Kellaway into the storage room and then turned and stood in the doorway, as if to physically block anyone from following him. "Go on, Mr. Kellaway. Take care of yourself."
"Thank you, Edward," Kellaway said.
Dusty steel shelving stood against the walls on either side, boxes on top of them. A grimy couch patched with duct tape had been shoved into a back corner next to a stained counter with a Mr. Coffee on it. A very narrow doorway opened into a dingy bathroom. A chain dangled from the fluorescent bar above the sink. Graffiti on the wall over the toilet. He didn't read it. He shut the door and slid the bolt. He sank to a knee, fished around in one pocket and came up with the deformed lead slug he'd picked out of the wall behind the shattered mirror. It had popped right out after a moment of working on it with his little multi-tool. He dropped it into the toilet. He had his story straight in his mind. He would tell the police he'd heard shooting and approach Devotion Diamonds to assess the situation. He'd heard 3 shots, but in his statement he would say he'd heard 4. It didn't matter what anyone else said. When people were panicked, details became mutable. 3 shots or 4, who could be certain how many they'd heard? He had entered and discovered 3 dead, the Muslim woman, her baby, and Roger Lewis. He'd encountered the shooter, the blonde, and they'd exchanged words. She moved to shoot, but he fired first, discharging his gun twice. He hit her with his initial shot, missed her with the second. They'd think that when he missed, the bullet went out the open window. Finally, the kid who looked like Jonah Hill had entered the shop, and the shooter with her dying breath had put a bullet in his fat, foolish face. In fact, Kellaway had fired her gun twice, once into the kid, once out the window. When forensics did the math, the empty shell casings would all add up right, 3 for Lewis. 1 for the Arab woman and her infant, and 1 for the fatso. He hit the flush. It clanked uselessly. He frowned and hit it again. Nothing. The lead slug sat in the bottom of the basin like a little squashy lump of turd. Someone knocked.
"Mr. Kellaway," said a voice he didn't know. "Are you all right in there?"
He cleared his throat.
"Just a minute."
His gaze drifted up to the wall, and for the first time he read what was scrawled in Sharpie. "Toilet fucked up. Use the public restroom."
"Mr. Kellaway, there's an EMT out here who'd like to examine you." "I don't need medical assistance."
"Yep, but he'd still like a look at you. You've been through what you'd call a traumatic experience."
"A minute," he said again.
Kellaway unbuttoned his left cuff and folded it back to the elbow, then plunged his hand into the water. He fished out the slug that had killed Yasmin Haswar and her child Ibrahim and set it on the floor.
"Mr. Kellaway, if I can do anything to help you..."
"No, thank you."
He lifted the heavy lid on the water tank behind the toilet and very gently set it on the seat. His left hand dripped. He picked up the slug and sank it in the water tank. Then he hefted the lid and carefully, quietly put it back in place. There would be a time, in a day or two, a week at the outside, to return and collect the slug and ditch it more permanently.
"Mr. Kellaway," came the voice on the other side of the door, "you need to let someone look at you. I'd like to have a look at you."
He ran the sink, washed and soaped his hands, splashed water on his face. He grabbed for a hand towel, but there weren't any left in the dispenser, and wasn't that always the way? There wasn't any toilet paper either. When he opened the door, his face was still wet, drops glittering in his eyebrows, in his eyelashes. The man on the other side of the door was a full foot shorter than him and wore a blue baseball cap that said, St. Pocenti Police. His head was an almost perfect cylinder, an effect exaggerated by the close cut of his pale yellow hair. His face was a burnished shade of red, the deep painless sunburn that all men of German descent acquired when they lived in the tropics for any length of time. His blue eyes glittered with humor and inspiration.
"Here I am," Kellaway said. "What do you want to look at?"
The man in the cap pressed his lips together, opened his mouth, closed it, opened it again. He looked like he might cry.
"Well, sir, my two grandchildren were in the mall this morning with their mother, my daughter, and they're all still alive, and so are a whole bunch more people. So, I guess I just wanted to know what a hero looks like."
And with that, St. Pocenti Police Chief J. Rickles took Kellaway in his arms and hugged him. 11:28 a.m. Lantern Glass saw the lights and heard the scream of sirens and was on her way to the mall before Tim Chen called to ask if she was busy.
"I'm about to be," she said. "I'm driving toward it now."
"The mall?"
"Uh-huh. What are they saying on the scanner?"
"Shots fired. All units. Multiple homicides."
"Oh, shit,"
was her thoughtful reply.
"Mass shooter?"
"Looks like it's our turn."
"How was the fire?"
Lantern Glass had spent the morning in a helicopter, buzzing up and down the edge of the fire blazing through the Ocala National Forest. The smoke was a filthy wall of brown cloud climbing 10,000 feet high and throbbing with a feverish umber light. Her escort was an official from the National Park Service, who had to yell to be heard over the steady whap of the rotor blades. He shouted unnerving trivia about state cuts to emergency services, federal cuts to disaster relief, and the good luck they'd had so far with the wind.
"Good luck? What do you mean you've had good luck with the wind?"
Lantern Glass had asked him.
"Didn't you say you were losing 1,000 acres a day to this thing?"
"Yeah, but at least the wind is blowing north," said the Park Service man. "It's pushing the fire into uninhabited scrub. If it turns to the east, this thing could be on top of St. Pocenti in 3 days.
Now Lantern Glass told her editor,
"The fire was a fire. Hot. Greedy. Impossible to satisfy."
"Hot. Greedy. Impossible to satisfy," Tim said, speaking very slowly, weighing each descriptive in turn. "How do you satisfy a fire?"
"Timmy, that was a setup. You were supposed to say, 'Sounds like my ex-wife.' You gotta work with me here. When I give you a perfect setup like that, you have to take it."
"I don't have an ex-wife. I'm happily married."
"Which is amazing, considering you are the least funny, most literal man in the ranks of American journalism. Why does she stay with you?"
"Well, I suppose the kids exert a certain pressure to remain together."
Aisha Lantern Glass made a buzzing sound, as if he'd replied with the incorrect answer on a game show.
"Wrong. Wrong. Try again, Timmy. You're the least funny man in American journalism, so why does your wife stay with you? Think carefully. This might be another prime setup."
"Because..."
His voice trailed off uncertainly.
"You can do it. I know you can do it."
"Because of my thick, uncircumcised penis?" he asked.
Lantern Glass whooped.
"There you go. Much better. I knew you had it in you."
By then she was turning into the lot at the mall and could see yellow sawhorses, ambulances, half a dozen cop cars. Blue and silver strobes stammered weakly in the near equatorial heat. It wasn't quite noon, and she already